Please pray after me, Mother Hamilton's prayer. O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
Saints and Sages of all religions, I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles,
and give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Me such great joy to be here tonight with all of us. Satsang, that is the term in India for coming together for spiritual purpose. Kindred spirits all coming together under the purpose and the guise of greater realization, greater understanding of our true and deeper nature in the spirit. I'd like to read from Paramahansa Yogananda, Divine Incarnations, God's Emissaries. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. With these words, Jesus placed his signature on a unique life that enthroned him everlastingly on the altar of worshipful hearts as the incarnation of God's loving compassion. The Good Shepherd of souls opened his arms to all, rejecting none, and with universal love coaxed the world to follow him on the path to liberation through the example of his spirit of sacrifice, renunciation, forgiveness, love for friend and enemy alike, and the supreme love for God above all else. As the tiny babe in the manger at Bethlehem, and as a Savior who healed the sick and raised the dead, and applied the salve of love on the wounds of errors, the Christ in Jesus lived among men as one of them, that they too might learn to live like gods. For mere mortals to cope with a life unsolved and unsolvable mysteries in an inscrutable universe created by the omnipotence of God, of the omniscient essence of his omnipresence, would indeed be an overwhelming challenge were it not for divine emissaries who come on earth to speak with the voice and authority of God for the guidance of man. Eons past, in ancient higher ages in India, rishis enunciated the manifestation of divine beneficence, of God with us. In terms of divine incarnations, avatars, God incarnate on earth in enlightened beings, the eternal, omnipresent, unchanging spirit has neither a corporal nor heavenly form called God. Nor, as the Lord Creator, does he fashion a form in which he then deigns to dwell among his creatures. Rather, he makes himself known through the divinity in worthy instruments. Many are the voices that have intermediated between God and man. Khanda avatars, or partial incarnations in God-knowing souls. Less common are purna avatars, liberated beings who are fully one with God. Their return to earth is to fulfill a God-ordained mission. The Lord, in the sacred Hindu Bible, the Bhagavad Gita, declares, "Whenever virtue declines and vice predominates, I incarnate as an avatar. In the visible form, I appear from age to age to protect the virtuous and to destroy evil doing in order to reestablish righteousness." The same one glorious infinite consciousness of God, the universal Christ consciousness, or Guttasta Chaitanya becomes familiarly appareled in the individuality of an enlightened soul, graced with a distinguishing personality and godly nature appropriate to the times and purposes of the incarnation. And so we hear from the lips of one who was an avatar himself, Paramahansa Yogananda, that God doesn't have a human form in the sense that we think of, perhaps some people conceptualize God as being this older man with a long beard and long hair sitting in some antiseptic corner of the universe that's handing out smotes and smites and judgments. But rather, God is the impersonal force, the spirit that was before anything else came into creation. This normally is inconceivable to the human mind because we are so habituated to subject-object thinking. We are the subject. The object is something that is outside of us. And therefore, it's natural for us to think that God is in his heaven, or we look up into the skies and into space. And yet, we've been into space and capsules and spaceships, and we have not been any closer to God there than we are here on earth. And we think of God oftentimes as a father figure, or if you're in India, a mother figure. Because in India, mother is at least popular conception as father is, probably much more so. I remember a young Christian friend of mine saying that it was a big joke. He thought it was very funny that the astronauts went up and they went around the moon. And when they came back from their silence going around the moon, one of the astronauts said, "We saw God here, and she was a black woman." And he just thought that was the funniest thing. And I just thought, well, he saw Mother Kali on the other side of the moon there, the dark side of the moon. That would be an appropriate place, by the way, for Mother Kali to be hanging out, is on the dark side of the moon. In India, there are so many representations of God. And some people see them then as polytheistic. But behind all the different images is a monotheistic theme that God is one. And God as absolute spirit cannot be conceived of in a human sense. But that God has taken incarnation down through the ages in different forms through perfected souls. What Master says here is that souls who have gained their perfection in God have no reason to reincarnate on earth again. Most of us are compelled to do so because we have built up a long chain of cause and effect, or karma. And what that does is it creates attachments inside of us. We are attached to positive things. We are attached to negative things. And all of those attachments keep us coming back to an earthly incarnation because it's only here on earth that we can work out those attachments. Once we resolve them, once we let go of them, then we are freed beings and we are no longer required to come back to this earth. Now, many people think that, well, when I die, then I'll know the truth. And then I'll come into my real self. And the problem is having this earthly body. And when I die, I'll go off to some far-off place, this kingdom of heaven that's talked about, and then I'll know everything. Now, there is a certain truth that when we leave this body, we do leave behind all the limitations that this body consciousness represents to us. And we are now in our astral self or even our causal self. And in that, we are hugely expanded. We are much more wise and attuned to the light. Because when we're here on earth, we become so encapsulated in human consciousness. And so we do get access if we've earned it. If we have very little development in consciousness at all, we might just simply go to sleep until we awaken in another life form within a body once again, because we've not even developed enough consciousness to stay aware or awake when we're in the astral. But gradually, as we develop even a little bit, we become consciously aware of our astral incarnation in between earthly incarnations. We take birth into a new astral body. We're not born through travail as we are here on the earth. We're just simply born into a more refined, more subtle body, although it feels very natural, it feels very real to us when we're there. And then we think back on this earthly incarnation, and it feels like we were wearing a heavy overcoat, a leaden overcoat the whole time, wearing this physical body, and now we feel freer. All we have to do in the astral realms is to think of going someplace, and in a body of light, we can go to that place. We can approach any tree, for instance, and ask it for some fruit. It doesn't even have to be a fruit that belongs to that tree. And that tree will issue forth that fruit that we yearn for. That it's always an even temperature. There is not the stress and strain that there is here on Earth. We had this little baby with us earlier today. And at one point it was crying because it was hungry. And in the astral realms, those kinds of pains and those kinds of stresses don't exist. There are other kinds of challenges that we have there. But it's not the same as this physical body. And so when we think of dying, oftentimes we're unconsciously remembering what it was like before we came into this earthly incarnation. And we yearn for that. There's many of us who aren't fully satisfied with being in this earthly form. We feel like we've been born into the wrong family. We feel like we're a stranger in a strange land. And why are people mistreating each other in the way that they do? Why are they mean to each other? And so on. And it's a rough and tumble place. Because in the astral realms, you mix only with those people who are like-minded with you. So why in the world would we ever choose to come into an earthly incarnation? And it's a complex thing, but I don't think we need to think too hard on it. In the sense that when you go to see a movie, do you always go to see a movie about good and lovely and beautiful things? And the answer is no. Sometimes you go and see movies about hardship. Sometimes it's contained with so much pathos that you find yourself crying during the movie itself. And then you walk out of the movie and you say, oh, what a good movie that was. Really? You were crying. You had tears. You were so sad. And yet that's how we feel, isn't it? Or we go to an adventure movie and we're just on the edge of our seat, barely breathing. And we walk out, oh, that was such a good movie. And so it gives us a little glimpse into what draws us and what attracts us into this material world exploration that we go into, this adventure. And how many adventures have you been in your lifetime? And you think, in the middle of it, oh my gosh, I never want to do that again. But later on you start thinking, oh, it'd be really nice to go on another adventure again. We get drawn to it. We want to be challenged. We want to have that experience. And so we've come into this earth sphere to have that experience. And yet while we're here oftentimes, we think this is the last place that I want to be. I am sick of this, and yet there's some attachment deep down that keeps drawing us back. If that were not true, we would immediately release ourselves from this earthly incarnation and we would be freed beings. So attachment is what is at the root of our coming back in an involuntary state. But for avatars, there's nothing compelling them to come to this earthly incarnation. So you might wonder, why would an avatar, a fully freed being, ever choose to come into this world, particularly when you think about the lives of avatars? You think about Jesus' life and what a difficulty from his very birth. He had people out to take his life. Same was true with Krishna. And Rama went through some very, very difficult times, these tremendous incarnations, and yet they have very, very difficult times of it. So it's not just here for fun and pleasure. They're here for a very specific purpose. And that is where we'll pick up with Master's commentary some more. With this intercession of God's love come to earth in example, message, and guiding hand of his avatars, it would scarce be possible for a groping humanity to find the path into God's kingdom midst the dark miasma of worldly delusion, the cosmic substance of human habitation. Lest his benighted children be lost forever in creation's delusive labyrinths, the Lord comes again and again in God-illumined prophets to light the way. The glory of Christ in the form of Jesus made visible the invisible light that leads to God. Because this periodic recurrence of divine incarnations is part of God's creative enterprise, signs of such a birth are imprinted on the grand master plan. Sages, through their awakened soul intuition, can read the heavenly inscriptions, and if it be in accord with God's will that such a future event be known, the prophecy and plain or veiled revelations. This is one of the many ways in which God assures his children of his awareness of their need for his presence amongst them. Of the future coming of Lord Jesus, several references in the Old Testament are cited by devout Christians and biblical scholars. From the book of the Isaiah prophet, "The Lord himself shall give you a sign. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel," translated as "God with us." "My servant shall deal prudently. He shall be exalted and extolled and be very high, so that he may sprinkle many nations. We are all like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way, and the Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was taken from prison and from judgment. He was cut out from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people was he stricken. He bare the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors." So these incarnations come in order to teach us, to show us of what is possible within mankind. Because of mankind's ignorance, oftentimes when incarnations come, they are seen as the one and the only. This is true in the East as well as in the West. However, the truth is, what they come to reveal, what they come to show us is our innate potentiality. All humanity may rise up and become sons of God. It is not just one son of God, but that we all are children of God, sons and daughters of the living God, of omnipresence, omniscience, and omnipresence. Continuing then with Master's commentary, divine intercession to mitigate the cosmic law of cause and effect by which a man suffers from his errors was at the heart of the mission of love Jesus came to fulfill. Moses brought the law from God to man, emphasizing the awful justice that befalls willful heedlessness. Jesus came to demonstrate the forgiveness and compassion of God, whose love is a shelter even from the exacting law. Similarly, Jesus was preceded by Gautama Buddha, the Enlightened One, whose incarnation reminded a forgetful generation of the Dharma Chakra, the ever-rotating wheel of karma, self-initiated action and its effects, which make each man, and not a cosmic dictator, responsible for his own present condition. Buddha brought heart back into the arid theology and mechanical rituals into which the ancient Vedic religion of India had fallen after the passing of the higher age, in which Bhagavan Krishna, India's most beloved of avatars, preached the way of divine love and God realization through the practice of supreme spiritual science of yoga, union with God. So this is a tremendous story that's being unveiled here. It's that these tremendous incarnations have come from time to time into human incarnation, and that we are all the beneficiaries. We are all uplifted. Each one takes on some of the karma of collective consciousness. And through the purification of that, they introduce these ideas, different aspects of divinity. For Moses, who is such a great, great soul, came and revealed the law out of compassion, saying, if you follow these ways, if you follow this law, it will help you to purify the mind. When your mind is purified, then you may see God. A pure heart shall see God. And so that was his special dispensation. Because when we are dealing strictly in the mind, and we are so wedded to the things of the senses, we have to be shown the way. We have to be shown what the law is and how to begin to purify this mind. That's a very important step. But when we have gone through this step and we have begun to purify the mind and the spirit is awakened inside of us, then comes the Christ consciousness. And the Christ consciousness rises superior to the law. The law is something of the mind. Christ consciousness is above the human mind. Our human mind has a reasoning capacity, but above the reasoning capacity is direct intuition of God. Now, this is a dangerous teaching, you might say, in this sense, that the human mind can misuse such things. There are people who have come along and they have said, I am the voice of God, or this is the voice of God speaking through me. And it hasn't been true. They've fooled others. Perhaps they've fooled themselves. And instead of leading the life of purity that they should, they've gone down some wrong paths. And as a result, they bring other people with them. And then when their illusion is discovered, then everybody's faith is shaken. Because now it's no longer true. The faith, the simplicity that people had within this God being. And it's a tremendous crime. It's a tremendous crime against humanity. So we can't play fast and loose. The thing I love about our path, the path of yoga, the path of meditation, the path that we follow is one that is of a spiritual science. Science will come up with a proposition, a theory. And with that theory, it'll have demonstrable results. And if we follow the theory, then we should be able to prove to ourselves, through our own experience, the truth of what is being spoken. And this is absolutely true with our path. There's nothing that has to be accepted on faith only. Certainly we have a certain amount of faith. We have a certain amount of inspiration to get started with. But then we put these principles into action. And if they be true, they will bear out certain truths. And one of the greatest truths was told to us by Sri Yukteswar when he was asked, what are the signs of God realization? And Yoganandaji was struggling with it in the moment. And what Sri Yukteswar recognized within Yoganandaji was he was wondering, if I am God realized, because he had been initiated into this deep samadhi state where he was in union with God. But in Master's mind, Yogananda's mind, he thought that if he had attained the highest, then he should have power over all this universe. Sri Yukteswar pointed out to him, you could have power over this entire universe and not have God realization. Those two things are not mutually exclusive, ignorance and power. That the sign of true God realization is ever new joy that wells up within your being. And so we have a measurement for our own God realization. How much peace, how much joy do we have in our life? How are things that happen in our life, people who enter into our life, how much are they likely to knock us off center, to make us so that we don't have that joy? Now this joy, this bliss, is not built upon circumstances or even having the right people around us, because we have no control over that many times. This kind of joy is something that bubbles up through the soul spontaneously and naturally. It is a bliss that begins to well up inside of us, and it finds absolute joy in the simplest of occurrences. Whether we have money or not, whether we have position or not, we can be walking down the street and just feel this overwhelming nature of bliss. I remember one time I was walking down a street right here in Vancouver. It was one of those quiet, treed, giant oak trees on both sides of the street. And I just felt so much God, just in the air, in the trees, in the grass, in all everything that surrounded me. And I thought, how can this be possible? It's free. You know, I don't have to pay anything. I don't have to have any special shoes or, you know, equipment or be in any particular place or special place. And it was almost overwhelming to have such joy for absolutely no reason on the outside at all. Nothing special was occurring. This is the kind of joy that we can have in busy times and non-busy times, when we're surrounded in people and when we're all by ourselves. It doesn't make any difference. And it is possible, so all the saints tell us, to become established in that joy, in that presence of God, no matter what's going on in our life. When you begin to grow in purity of mind, then even things that come at you, let's say somebody close to you leaves the body and dies, or there's some illness or some problem like that, and in the past, that would have thrown you for a loop. You would have felt separated, cut off from God. Even when you feel grief coming up in your heart, you feel that that is God who is grieving through you, grieving for his children, grieving for any losses. And that when you have some illness, then you dig deeper and you draw more deeply from the well of your own God realization, the spirit and the power of God within you. If somebody that you know has an illness or has some difficulty that they're dealing with, instead of being disappointed in God and how he runs his universe, you draw more deeply from the well of living waters. And you pour those living waters upon that one who's having difficulty. And it is a bottomless well. There is no limit to God's love, to God's healing energy, God's peace, God's compassion. The only limits are the ones that we place upon it. And so when you feel that you are a conduit for this infinite life, this infinite consciousness flowing through you, you become as the avatars are. Now, avatars come with a special mission, a special dispensation. And it has a worldwide effect in what they do. But each one of us has a mission. Each one of us has something to fulfill. God has put us in situations in order to bring our light, to share our light, to give it to one and all. It's the most exciting, it's the most wonderful, it's the most adventurous life you can possibly think of. Sometimes people think of a spiritual life and they think of somebody like the church lady who's got her nose turned up at everybody and disapproving of this, that, and the other thing, and it couldn't be further from the truth. A life filled with unlimited joy, unlimited light, unlimited potential for service, and it doesn't withhold you from life. You enter into life. I deal with every aspect of life. I deal with those people who are struggling with drug addictions. I deal with those people who are dealing with all and every sort of life experience. Now, I've told you before about the woman that I was working with in in a counseling kind of situation, and when she said, oh yes, I used to do the Mother Teresa thing, and I knew what she meant by that. I knew that she meant she used to give everything to her work and to the people that she worked with, but she burned out in it, you see. She used to do it, you notice. Not that she still does. And so I asked her, I said, oh, did you start your morning every morning with 2 hours of prayer and meditation like Mother Teresa? Oh, no, I didn't do that. Well, she missed the whole Mother Teresa thing. Mother Teresa was not a social worker as much as she was a conduit for her Christ. And how did she saw it? She saw her beloved Christ in everyone that she met. And that didn't mean she went around trying to convert everybody. She went to the streets of Calcutta and she would pick people up if they were dying, if they were sick. She'd pick them up in her own arms. She would carry them back to her place. She would bathe them. She would give them clean clothes. Sometimes she could do no more than that for them. But she would give them dignity. She would give them the love of God inside of her. She would give them what she could. And it was tremendous. And she's turned into a world archetype for service. Beautiful, selfless service. And you see, this is how we can be in our life. Now, it doesn't mean that because she lived in poverty, that she had a poverty of spirit. Because she was tremendous in God. When Mother Hamilton met her, she said, you know, really, she's physically, she's a homely person. Large nose and deep lines etched into her face. But that she exuded such a light that she was beautiful. Beautiful in God. Master one time asked Sri Yukteswar, when he resurrected after leaving the body, he came back and physically incarnated, much as Jesus had during his resurrection. And Master asked him, are all the people in the astral realms beautiful? And Sri Yukteswar said, we don't measure beauty there in the same way that it's measured oftentimes here on earth. Beauty in the astral realms is, what does your aura look like? What is the light around you? Can you imagine if we measured beauty that way? Can you imagine doing it yourself when you meet somebody? Whether you see auras or not, you may get a feeling that this person is a wonderful person. They have a very pure, clean aura about them. And somebody else just, oh, you just feel like taking a shower after you walk away from them. It's just not nice. And it doesn't have anything to do, perhaps, with their physical appearances. It is all about spirit. It is all about their body of light. And if we can begin to sensitize ourselves to it, we'll recognize when people have that light. Mother Hamilton talked about meeting a man out in a small town. It was called Duval, outside of Seattle. And it was an antique store, and one of the devotees had taken her out there. They were out for a drive, and they decided to stop in at this store. And she was looking at this counter, and suddenly the man behind the counter asked her if she needed some help. And she looked at him, up at him, and she saw his eyes, and she just recognized this was a tremendous spirit. Now, the man was rather heavy, and there wasn't anything extraordinary on the outside to indicate what a tremendous spirit this man was in God. But for somebody to recognize him in that way, one time Mother was in the Fiji Islands, and she was taking an elevator up in the hotel that she was in, and the woman got on, and the woman was quite beautiful, little older woman. And suddenly the woman just looked at Mother, and she said, who are you? She says, you have the most powerful spiritual and animal magnetism of anybody I've met in my life. Can you imagine somebody saying such a thing to you? I could about Mother, because she did. She was beautiful. She's a beautiful woman on the physical plane, even in her 70s. And that's her age at the time. But what a powerhouse. What a spiritual, towering figure she was. And so when we see one another in our light bodies, what we exude, we see each other more truly, more purely than when we just take in the physical being only. Now, Mother always talked to us about trying to wear nice clothes and our hair and so on to honor God within us. It's not done out of vanity, but it's to express the beauty that naturally resides inside of us. And that we don't have to dress down. We don't have to throw ashes in our food. We can see God in everything. This is the difference between the yoni and the bhakti. The yoni sees this world and sees it as an obstruction to God. And so it's something that must be done away with. And in truth, our attachments have to be done away. But they're not the problem. This world and its objects are not the problem. It's our attachment to them. And so when we practice to see everything as God, you see, that is the way of the bhakti. It's inclusive. And we must be careful that we do it truly and rightly. But when we see beautiful things, we're coming into the Christmas season now, and if we see the lights or the decorations or all the different festivities that are going on, and we see God in all of this, you see, then this world turns into almost a kind of fairyland. There are times in spiritual experiences where you will feel that it's almost like fairy dust has been sprinkled onto everything. It's like you live in this wonderland. And it's not something that stays with you always, but it's experiences that you are brought into as this kundalini rises up. You see, the birth of the Christ begins with Joseph and Mary. And inwardly, see, everything has an outer story, but it also has an inward story. And Joseph is that pineal gland, and Mary is the pineal gland. And they both have secretions. And when we have developed ourselves to a certain extent, then these secretions come together and they form a Christ seed. And that Christ seed makes its way down the ganglionic system. And when we are meditating deeply, we see a light in the ajna, or the third eye point. And that is the five-pointed star that we see at Christmas time. And then that seed travels down this nervous system and is deposited into a conical cave-like area just behind the stomach. And that Bethlehem means house of bread. And you can see how everything that's talked about in these scriptures are about an outer event, perhaps, but very definitely describes the inner events. And this is universal language, a universal language. It's not just for Christians. It's not just for Hindus. It's for everyone, if it be true. It's for all human beings everywhere. This is the universal nature of God and God realization. This is the message that was meant to be sent out with these avatars. Now, we cannot find fault with the avatars because lesser minds and lesser spirits later on took these teachings, misrepresented them, used them for their own purposes. They've been twisted and mangled to the point where they're almost unrecognizable. But one of the things about having the inner meaning not known is that so much of the story can be left and the inner meaning remains. And it's time, it's high time, for the inner meaning of these stories to come forward and for people to recognize the universal nature of these teachings. Now, it can be that someone will feel a special affinity for where they were raised, the stories that they have heard from since they were young, and that you should always have a special feeling for that. But you can recognize that the same story is being told all around this world in different languages, using different names, but it's the same story. Isn't that wonderful? You don't have to deny, and you certainly don't have to fight over these things. It's such a misguided notion. What we should be fighting is ignorance. Jihad, in its original sense, is the fight against ignorance, fighting against those things that are not of God. But you see how when the material mind gets hold of that, how it twists the meaning to where you could actually kill others, even kill yourself in the name of jihad. The truth is that the ego should be surrendered or killed on the altar of God, in order to transcend the limitations of the human ego and to be born or resurrect the divine ego within you, and that you should know God, that you should know God. We are all the great beneficiaries of these God beings who have come. And I'd like to read you one last quote here from Mother Hamilton. And she was saying, "Now, if I had any pride, if I had any ego left, it would certainly be in operation, because I have been told by one of the great masters in India that I was one of the 12 real living yogis in the world today. And I have been told by quite a few others that I am an avatar." But she says of herself, "I am only a child of God, the smallest of the small, the littlest one on the totem pole in my estimation." And this is how she felt about herself. And yet she came into this world as a lamb without any mark on it. Perfect. No karma of her own. She came out of compassion and love for this world. And she described how when she... Because oftentimes, avatars come in a state of ignorance in order to go through all the things that all human beings do, including all the sadhana, maybe even more difficult sadhana than the average person or most people would have to go through. And they go through all of that so they show what is to be done and that it can be done. And when she came to that state of perfect realization once again that she had already attained before coming into this world, you can imagine having perfect claim on God and then surrendering all of that in order to come into this earthly incarnation, all for the benefit of mankind. And when she was lifted up to that highest state, she looked out upon this world and she realized that she could just simply let go of the body and expand into perfect and total freedom in God. In fact, everything inside of her just wanted to do that, feeling the freedom, feeling the bliss, feeling the absolute perfection of God. And it was lifting her up so much that everything inside of her wanted to go. But she looked down upon this world, and she saw the suffering of humanity. She saw all the things that people went through, and her heart went out to this world. And so she thought to herself, "I want to come back into body consciousness." And she had to fight to do it because this bliss was so overwhelming. She just kept on wanting to go up into total spirit. And she really had to work to bring the body, the consciousness back down into body consciousness. She preserved her oneness with God, but now she could operate in the body. But there's a certain cost to that. But she wanted to do that so that she could fulfill the mission for which she had come. And this is the love and the compassion of these great God beings that they have for us. And where would we be without them? How would we know the path? How would we know how to attain this path? When the Buddha went into his complete emancipation, and he eventually came back down into body consciousness. And then he thought about, is this teachable? Can I teach it? And he thought, no, it's impossible. What I'm experiencing is so radically different than what most other people have any reference to. I can't do it. But his compassion continued to work inside of him. And eventually he was able to come up with his Four Noble Truths, and the eightfold path that came out of his own expression of his own spirit. And so this is the thing that went forth as his teachings. But you know, he wasn't in favor of having any images of God. He had seen the misuse of images of God. And yet, when we look out on this world, are there any other religious images more reproduced than the Buddha? I challenge you to find one. There are so many in every garden, in every so many homes, every place, all over the place. It's exactly what he didn't want. And it's because the human mind needs that subject-object in the beginning. It needs to focus on the thing, something, some image, some ishta of God, in order for it to really begin to know how to approach God, to think of God. If it's simply the beginningless, endless, without form, pure spirit, it's very difficult. So the mind is given some image of God in the beginning. True God-realized beings, though, are different than ordinary human beings. If you were to approach an ordinary human being, it would be like approaching a closed door. You just get the human being. They may have good qualities, lovely qualities. But a God-realized being is like an open door, and as you approach them, you go right through the door. You don't stop at the personality. You don't stop at the image. You go right straight through into the divine consciousness, and that is the difference. But we should never rest satisfied, completely satisfied, with any image of God until we have gone the whole way. But when the mind is needful of it, we can use a form of God to focus our mind upon, realizing that that image is a transitional metaphor, that it takes us from the human to the divine. And therefore, we can stay focused upon these yogis, these avatars, these ones who have come to bring the light to us. And when we really settle into that and deepen our attention, deepen our reverence, you know, when we think about the baby Jesus, as I said, we had a baby here tonight, and it just awakens everybody's love, doesn't it? So much innocence and so much just innocence of being. It awakens that inside of us. And to think of that baby Jesus being born in just all of that original innocence, all of that light, to the point that the spheres themselves, the heavenly spheres, are singing with bliss. And it's one of those sacred, sacred nights. You see, by meditating upon that, letting your mind dwell upon it, it brings you into that state of peace where the angels are singing in bliss, where light is naturally emanating through the darkness, where the star is lighting the way. And you can let that transitional metaphor, you can let that image take you into your own heavenly realms. So recognize the power of these avatars. They're wonderful. And they're gifts to humanity. And wherever we encounter one, I've been rereading the story of the Ramayana, the story of Rama. And it's so touching. And there's times of extreme tenderness. And there's times of loss and all the rest of it. And in India, when people are listening to these stories, tears are just streaming down their eyes. They've heard it over and over again. It only deepens their feeling of connection to these stories. And so when we develop this kind of devotion, you don't need to try to think on something when you love something. When you really love it, you don't have to try. It's not a discipline. A lovely young man that I knew that was up by Babaji's cave at the ashram up there. And that he would work hard all day long. And I don't quite remember, it was 5 or 5:30, and he would get off of work, so to speak. And he would run to the Bhajan hall in order to play the harmonium and to sing chants. Here he'd been working in the ashram all day long, and I saw him literally running to the Bhajan hall. He couldn't wait to get there and start singing to God and playing to God. Is that not inspirational? At Ananda Ashram, at the end of the day, all the workers, for half an hour, they sing Ram Nam, this Ram Nam that we were singing beforehand. And it's some of my most favorite music to listen to. And it's all the workers. These are not the great saints who have shown up and all of that. These are just the workers who work all day long. But they sing this all together before they go home at night. Can you think of just before leaving work, singing Ram Nam for a half an hour with 40 or 50 other people? And just how would that feel going home after doing that? So let us get this spark of devotion, of love for God. It's not a discipline anymore. And certainly some days are easier than other days. But this path of devotion will positively draw you toward God. Lift your heart, soften your heart, open your heart to the One. And you will begin a new life, a new journey back to God, until He becomes your all and all in all. And you find that God vibration everywhere, everywhere, in everyone, regardless of the masks that they wear. And then you will have your freedom, complete and total freedom in the One. Om Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram means victory to God, victory to the light, victory to God within you, victory to the light within this whole world, and that this whole world should be inflamed with that light, divine love. All people everywhere seeking out ways to serve each other. This is wonderful and it is beautiful. And we are the forerunners of what is to come. And it will come. It will come. Now, if we will sing a little bit of Ram Nam, if you'll sing after me, sing a response. Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram
Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai
Ram
Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai
Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai
Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram
Om. Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram
Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om. Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram
Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram
Om. Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram
Om.
Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ramo.
Shri Ram, 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 Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ramo. Om Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram, Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram, Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram, Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram.
O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
I feel the wonder and the beauty
of thy glorious presence
in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet
and surrender myself to thee.
I feel the power of thy perfection
surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence
are radiant with thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss
of my communion with thee.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am he. To ask for special healing ohms for Christine here with us tonight, who recently was told by the oncologist that there's been a spread of cancerous cells in her body. And that we know that in God, all things are possible. I was reading an article recently in which there's been experimental proof in Russia where they have shown that DNA and RNA can be affected even by the words that we speak. And it's some fascinating kinds of experiments that are going on there. And you think of the power of affirmations. You think of the power of these mantras that we are given. Thousands of years, yogis and yoginis have enunciated these vibrations and risen all the way up to God. Not only that, but that there have been tremendous, powerful healings as a result. And so to awaken pure God consciousness within a being can radically change the physical nature of the body. And to bring healing where before there was illness and sickness, to bring order where there was disorder, to bring prosperity where there had been poverty, and so on. And to know deep within our beings that this awakening power is a potential waiting to be awakened. within you and within all. And so I'm thinking of Christine in particular, and to think about the perfection of God residing within every cell, within every part of her being, and sending out healing ohms to her, and through those healing ohms, through singing out the word Om, you are sending that vibration, that love, that light, that perfection, and that every cell in her body and in her being sing with that perfect vibration, with that blissful, joyful vibration, and that God bring healing, perfection, body, mind, and soul. So we can remain seated in this case and picturing within your mind's eye, sending forth that healing vibration and feeling that you are an instrument, a conduit through which that infinite vibration may pass through you. So let us send out those healing ohms now. Peace. Bliss. Amen.